And go ahead and begin. My name is Christine Carlson. The title of this session is Our Mother in Heaven. I don't know how you reacted to the title of this session. It's perhaps a new idea to you to think about the person or the one who is in heaven as a mother, as Mother God. Maybe it was old hat to you, maybe it was new. Chances are it maybe was a little new. Still is to me also. Probably had a range of feelings, reactions to that title when you saw it on the board or heard it announced this morning. Maybe you were intrigued by it, curious about it. Maybe it startled you, could have even repulsed you. I'm aware of those range of feelings or responses to this topic, to the idea of addressing God as mother, to the idea of using female language to talk about God. And in the talk, I'd like to be sensitive to those responses that are probably represented in the room, but also plunge ahead and talk about this issue that is maybe new and kind of tentative to most of us. As we'll see today, although it seems like a new thing to us to talk about God as mother, actually talking about God as mother is as old as the hills. Biblical writers were talking about God, writing about God in female language, imaging God as mother several thousand years ago in the first century BC. These images have been buried in the Old and New Testaments. Infrequently, they've appeared during various times of history. Some writers, like the medieval mystics, Julian of Norwich is one of them, have found these images and written about them, prayed with them, and then they've sort of gone back into those dusty corners of the Bible, back on library shelves, and haven't reappeared again for several centuries. We're in a time now, especially with the emergence of the women's movement in the 60s and 70s, and the result of that in biblical studies of feminist approaches to studying the Bible. These dusty corners where these images of God have been hidden and collected dust have been investigated again. And people have gone into these areas, found these images, pulled them out, dust covered as they were, cleaned it off, and started holding them up to the light and looking at them and examining them and thinking about them and talking about them again. And that's what I'd like to do with you this morning. Like the woman in Luke's parable who lost a coin and searched her whole house top to bottom to find that one lost coin, I'd like today to search out some of the corners of Scripture for some of these dust-covered images of God as mother. I'd like to do three things with them with you this morning. I'd like to find them and examine them first. Then I'd like to consider what we do with them. Once we've found them, where do we go with these images? How do we use them, incorporate them into our lives? And then I'd also like to discuss what they do to affect our understanding of God and our understanding of ourselves. Are we any different because we know about these images? Is God any different to us because we know about these images? Those are the three things I'd like to do with you today. And to begin, I'd like to work in some detail with the psalm that I have horribly written up here on the board. I was telling people, you can tell I was never an elementary school teacher. My board handwriting is an F, I think. But I've written it here, and I hope big enough so that you can find it. So that you can read it. If not, refer to your RSV or to the LBW. This is my own translation from the Hebrew, so it's a little different than what you would have in the RSV or LBW, but they're close enough so we can refer back and forth. I have long been intrigued by this little psalm and moved by it. I spent most of my life never knowing about it. I first encountered it in college when a friend of mine was in a religion class where he was assigned the task of memorizing a psalm. And he was joking around at dinner one night about memorizing Psalm 131 because it's one of the shortest psalms in the Bible. And I realized that I had never read Psalm 131 or heard about it. So I went back to my room that night, got out my Bible, and read Psalm 131 for the first time in my life. And it charmed me. It sort of took me over. And I couldn't get away from this psalm. And it sort of surprised me that three little verses could be that powerful and that profound for me. But ever since, I've been living with this psalm in various ways. And especially in the last year, when I was pregnant and had a baby and I'm now a nursing mother, this psalm has become an even more personal psalm for me and an important psalm. So I'd like to take us through this psalm, which is very, it looks simple and short on the surface, but which is very intricately wrought, and walk us through this psalm to see how it works to develop an image of God as a mother. First, let's read this psalm together, and if you can find it in the LBW, let's read it responsively. It's on page 281. Let's divide up men and women, and why don't the...
Start with the women.
We'll start with the women instead. All right. Women start. And let's read to the red star, and then men will respond with the second line. O Lord, I am not proud. I do not occupy myself with great matters. But I still my soul and make it quiet, like a child upon its mother's breast.
My soul is quiet within me.
O Israel, wait upon the Lord from this
time.
Amen. I'd like to give you a little background on the Psalms first. This is a real crash course in the Psalms. Some of my work is based on a book by Klaus Westermann, who's the author of the book that Charlie Mays has been leading a discussion on. And it's a book entitled The Psalms. Westermann identifies four general categories of psalms, and I've listed them over here. They seem so simple on the surface, but no one ever seems in scholarship to have done much with this before Westermann. He was a prisoner in a war camp during the Second World War, and the only book that he had was a New Testament with the Psalms at the back of it. So when he was interred as a prisoner in this war camp, he studied the Psalms. That's what he lived with every day in this prisoner of war camp. And when he came out then, he has been writing about the Psalms ever since. And he describes four general psalm categories. Individual praise. And when you read a psalm, if it uses the personal pronoun I and a verb of praise, like sing, shout, make a joyful noise, then you know that it's in that category. There's also a community praise psalm. We sing. Just uses the plural pronoun instead of the singular. Then he identifies an individual lament. I cry, I mourn, I sob, I plead to you, O God. Psalms with those pronouns and verbs are individual laments. And then he identifies a community lament. We cry, we sorrow, we call on you for help, O Lord. The psalm that we're studying today is an individual psalm, if you'll notice it. Yahweh, my heart, uses the personal pronoun. And it's, however, not a true praise or lament psalm. For every rule, there's an exception. And Westermann couldn't get this in the four general categories. So he calls this particular psalm that we're studying today a confession of confidence. It's also called a song of trust. It's a subcategory of the individual lament psalms. So that's just some background for you. Another interesting thing that he says about these confession of confidence psalms is that they're rooted originally in the lament psalm. I'll go through this very briefly. He identifies a structure of the lament psalms that there are exceptions to this also, but generally they follow this pattern. They'll begin with an address to God. And often it's an elaborate address to God, almost as if to court God or praise God or demand God's attention. Sometimes it will be several verses that this address to God will continue. Then the lament psalm goes into a complaint, first against God. Oh Lord, why have you gotten me into this trouble? Why are my enemies hating me? It's your fault, oh God. Then the psalmist will go on to complain about others. My enemies are terrible people. My brothers and sisters hate me. My family has abandoned me. You know the Psalms. And then the psalmist will complain about his the predicament in which the speaker finds himself. This is the pits. I'm just down here muddling around, and it's horrible. Then every lament psalm, there is no exception to this rule, every lament psalm ends with a petition that affirms that the complaint has been reversed. God has heard the cry of the complaining psalmist, and every lament psalm ends on a hopeful note. There's no lament psalm, at least that I have been able to find, that ends with a complaint. It's always that this complaint has been reversed, and I affirm my assurance in God as my deliverer. What Vestermann theorizes, and I think it's an interesting theory, is that the Confession of Confidence Psalm is formerly a petition affirming that the complaint has been reversed, and that in the history of the Psalms that has been separated out and made into its own little psalm. And that's what he thinks has happened with this Psalm 131, that originally it was attached to the body of a lament psalm, and it stood as this third part here. But in the as the people use the psalms in their worship and in their private meditation, this third part got separated out and now stands as a separate psalm. That's how he explains how this psalm came to be. And I think that that's kind of an interesting theory. So, and I hope that you will find that interesting also. So the one thing that we know about this psalm, Vestermann says it must be read with the backdrop of a lament scene behind it. This psalm is being said or read with a dire threat sort of hanging over it. And so that's one thing. And the other thing that we know before we come to the psalm then is that the speaker's plight has been reversed. The speaker was in a former condition, and now this psalm asserts that the speaker is in a reverse reversed situation. So now let's get into the psalm and look at it more closely, and we can see how Vestermann's theories hold up. You'll notice that the psalm begins with the word Yahweh, and that's all that there is as an address to God. The psalmist says simply Yahweh. There are no adjectives that flatter Yahweh or praise Yahweh. There are no imperatives that demand Yahweh's attention. It's very simple and stark. The simple word, Yahweh. And then the speaker seems to assume that Yahweh has turned and is hearing the speaker and goes on to talk then, to address Yahweh. My heart is not proud and my eyes are not haughty. It's interesting that at the beginning of this psalm, it begins with negatives. My heart is not proud. My eyes are not haughty. And this is where we get some sense of what the speaker's previous condition was. They imply a reversal. Once my heart was proud. Once my eyes were haughty. Now my heart is not proud. My eyes are not haughty. That gives a clue to what the backdrop of this psalm is. The speaker is also negated in these first two lines. In the Hebrew, I won't give you a Hebrew lesson, but in the Hebrew, the speaker is buried just as in the English verbs. There is no I subject in those first two lines. The speaker is hidden, out of sight, negated also. So the first two lines are very negative, sort of, these negative verbs and no speaker apparent. The speaker finally emerges in the third line, I do not walk in places too great or too exalted for me. Here you get the subject finally. And in a short psalm, that's a long wait for the speaker to emerge. But it's interesting that the speaker emerges again with the negative verb in the Hebrew and in the English, I do not walk. So again, speaker is negated, even when the speaker appears with the verb I. And then there are some height images that we should look at in these first four lines. The obvious ones in English are places too great or too exalted for me. That can imply big buildings, ostentatious places where this speaker has walked. In the Hebrew, and I've tried to capture it in the English translation, but it's hard. In the Hebrew, these words, proud and haughty, also imply height. And I chose the words proud and haughty because haughty comes from the French word haute, or tall or high, if you know French at all. And proud is not quite as clear, but one of the meanings in heraldry is the way a peacock's fan spreads out. What is small and down on the ground, like the peacock's tail trailing behind it, suddenly stands up and expands. And that's one of the meanings of proud, you know, standing up tall and expanding out. And so all of those four words in the Hebrew imply height images. That becomes important later on. Moving into the second verse, we find the speaker again. And now the speaker has emerged from the shadows of the negative action, I do not walk, into positive action. I have smoothed and stilled myself. It's interesting that these two verbs, smoothed and stilled, respond to the height images in the first verse. We talked about not proud, not haughty, places too great or too exalted for me, all images of height. And then we get to these verbs, I have smoothed and stilled. What was once tall and puffed up and expanded has become leveled, smoothed and stilled like water. So the height images have collapsed, and the speaker is now still. Myself is still like a lake with no ripples on it. And in verses in the second and third lines of verse 2, then the speaker tells how this reversal has happened. Once the speaker was puffed up with pride, now the speaker is still and smooth. And how has that happened? The speaker has become like a weaned child upon its mother's breast, as a weaned child is myself. Lying prone in the mother's arms, sucking at her breast, this speaker, who once ran around like an independent, self-sufficient child who could feed itself and get along all on its own, independent of the mother, is now back lying in the mother's arms at its source of nurture, dependent once again on the mother for nurture and for life. And the other thing that has happened is that the speaker has found myself. In Hebrew, the word self is not captured by the English translation soul. Self in Hebrew, the word is nefesh, means my emotional self, my spiritual self, my whole being, my physical body, everything that I am. And soul has become such an ethereal, airy word, I think, in English. So I translated it self. And that's really what this speaker means. I have found my total self lying here at my mother's breast. Verse 3 then further enriches this serene scene. It begins with the only imperative of the whole psalm, and this is rather unusual. You find a lot of imperatives in psalms, and that imperative is wait. Wait, Israel, upon Yahweh. We've also moved from personal address to now the community is addressed. Wait, Israel. The speaker has been talking about the self, and now the speaker turns and says, Israel, turns to the community. Wait, Israel, upon Yahweh. And then the analogy is developed between the first two verses and the third verse, and I'd like to explore that now, because that's where some exciting stuff happens, I think. As the speaker and the speaker's self, as we've seen, have waited upon their mother's breast, so Israel is to wait upon Yahweh. That's the analogy that's being drawn in this psalm poem between the first two verses and the third verse. As the speaker was proud and haughty, walking in great places, and had been, then lying at its mother's breast had become smoothed and stilled, so Israel is not to be proud or haughty, or to seek exalted places, or to try to get into important positions of power. But instead, Israel, like this child, is to lie at the breast of Yahweh, dependent once again on Yahweh. Instead of being independent, self-sufficient, and full of pride, Israel is to become like a weaned child going back to its mother, back to Yahweh, to the breast of Yahweh, where it was originally nurtured, and find there its sustenance. There's movement in this psalm. In verses 1 and 2, we talk about the individual speaker, as I've said. In verse 3, we move to the community Israel. In verses 1 and 2, we find intimate, personal language, talking about the relationship between a child and its nursing mother. In verse 3, we find liturgical language. Wait, Israel, upon Yahweh, now and forever. Those are phrases from the worship life, the corporate worship life of Israel. And what's interesting to me is that the personal, intimate language and images of the first two verses are an analogy for the liturgical, corporate language of the third verse. We've moved also from private confession to public worship, community worship in the third verse. And I guess those are the movements that I see, at least in the psalm. And we have developed this analogy where the experience of a child nursing at its mother's breast points to the experience of the community of Israel and its relationship with Yahweh. There's a change in this psalm. The speaker, who was once proud and haughty and desired great places and pride and wealth, you could expand the list, has become a whole person lying at the nursing mother. There's also continuity, and this is the last thing I'd like to say about this psalm, I guess. It begins with Yahweh, and Yahweh is the final word in the psalm. The final person of the psalm. Yahweh is the Alpha and the Omega of the psalm. And in a way, it's as if Yahweh is the arms cradling this psalm, the beginning and the end. Yahweh is the arms that contains the speaker child, the children of Israel. And so the structure of the psalm parallels the theme of the psalm, which is real interesting to me. It's simple. It's just three verses. But I think that this psalm contains a great truth, that as a nursing mother comforts and nurtures her child, so Yahweh comforts and holds and sustains us. What we've been talking about and working with here is a metaphor. And I'd like to talk for a little while about metaphor now and how that works and why that's important for this subject. A metaphor has been described in an ancient Chinese poem as a finger pointing to the moon. And I think that that's a good definition, if a poetic definition, of what a metaphor is. The finger is something human, it's physical, it's something I look at and work with every day. I know my finger pretty well. And the moon, however, is something distant, it's untouchable. I'm not one of the astronauts who's ever been there, so I don't have that experience. And what a metaphor does is to act like the finger, which is known well, close to me, a part of my life and my experience. And that metaphor points then to something that is more abstract, something that's distant, something that's unknown. So you know the finger, you don't know the moon, but what the metaphor does is to help you get some idea of what the moon is all about. Draws a picture of the moon in an earthy, physical way so that I can know the moon. The metaphor thus moves us from the concrete to the abstract, the human to the divine, the physical to the unearthly. It can move that way and help us understand all those things. There's another important thing to keep in mind about a metaphor, I think, and that is that the finger never equals the moon. The finger never becomes the moon. They are separate, and they always stay separate. The finger points to the moon, gives us some idea about what the moon is, but they never become one another. We use metaphors when we talk about God. This last week, Evelyn Strang on Thursday night had a chapel service here where she talked about God as our rock. She showed slides of rocks and had little kids bring their rocks. And she developed many of the aspects of that metaphor of the rock and how God is like a rock. But she stressed several times in her talk that the rock is not God. And I thought that was really important for little kids especially to say that. But for us adults also, I thought it was important that she kept reminding us that. If the rock were God, we'd worship the rock. We wouldn't have to worship God then. But she stressed over and over the difference between the rock and God. Although the rock can point us to God, can tell us about aspects of God, they're never equal. They never equal one another. And I think that that's an important thing to remember when we start using more familial or relational language when we talk about God also. We have rich images that talk about God as Father, for instance. And that's the traditional image that I know I've grown up with. But it's important to remember that Father never equals God, that Father points to God. Father gives us a rich, complex picture of what God is, of who God can be. And because we have relationships with fathers, we can know then what a relationship like God, this distant, more mysterious, difficult to know being, what our relationship with God can be like. But we should never make the mistake of assuming that Father equals God, just like rock does not equal God. And it's the same thing with using mother language then, I think, in talking about God. We're not claiming that mother equals God. We're talking about mother as a metaphor that points to God. And I thought Ron Burke's chapel talk was a good example of this last week also, when he, some of you might not have been here, but briefly he told a story about two twins inside of their mother, and one wanted to be born and one was afraid to be born. And he used that as an analogy to how we are with death. Some of us are, we're hopeful about death, and some of us are afraid to die. And in that story, he was developing a rich image of God as a mother with these two twins inside of her. And that was for me a rich mother kind of metaphor. I think that sometimes we forget that it's metaphors that we're working with when we use God language, when we talk about God as rock or father or mother. And it's important, I think, to remember that God is greater than all of our linguistic efforts to talk about God. Beyond all of our language, we can never finally name God. But we can try, and this is what's exciting to me about mother images for God, that they expand our understanding of God. They make our relationship with God fuller and richer, I think. I have a relationship with my father that has helped me my whole life know what God is like, how good and gracious and loving God can be to me. But I also have a rich and full relationship with my mother that, since I have begun to think about God as mother, using mother images to talk about God, I've seen that the way my mother and I have related, which is different from the way my father and I have related, that our relationship can also tell me about what God is like, who God is for me in my life. So that's one, for me, one of the exciting things. The mother language is another finger pointing at the moon, another image to tell us about God that can expand our understanding of God and make our experience of God richer and fuller, I think. I'd like to explore briefly with you other mother images of God, particularly in the Old Testament. And there aren't very many of them. It's true that when you stack up male images of God against female images of God, there are very few of these. But they're there, and I think that it's important to know them and then to begin to work with them in our lives. So let's look first, if you brought your Bibles, if you need one, there are some in the back shelf below the LBWs back there. baby from the womb. But it is another image of a midwife standing there at the birth, yeah? Oh, I'm sorry, Isaiah 49, verse 1. But it is an image of a midwife being there at the birth, calling this baby forth from the mother, and then naming the name of the child when it's been born. Those are just to move us into some images of God as a birthing mother. Let's go back to Psalm 22, verse 10.
What is that one?
Psalm 22, verse 10. Remember, we looked at verse 9 for the midwife image. This is a rich, these are two rich verses here. The image of God as midwife in verse 9 moves into an image of God as a birthing mother in verse 10. Upon thee was I cast from my birth. The image is of God as the midwife there catching the baby and then putting it to the mother. And at that same time, God, in a very fluid way, becoming the mother upon whom this baby is cast. Upon thee was I cast from my birth, and since my mother bore me, thou hast been my God. There's another image in Isaiah 42, verse 14. This is a very earthy, gutsy image, I think. For a long time, and this is God speaking, for a long time I have held my peace. I have kept still and restrained myself. Now I will cry out like a woman in travail. I will gasp and pant. And here's very explicit metaphoric language in which God is being compared to a woman in labor, working hard and making noises and doing this earthy stuff of producing life. And God is this birthing mother. That's a very powerful image for me of God. There's another one in Deuteronomy verse 32, chapter 32. Define Deuteronomy first. Verse 18. It's part of a long poem. Chapter 32, verse 18. And this is particularly interesting in the Hebrew because it works with both father and mother language, which is very difficult to capture in the English. The RSV has done a pretty good job of it, I think. You were unmindful of the rock. Here we have rock imagery for God, as we've talked about earlier from Evelyn's chapel talk. You were unmindful of the rock that begot you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. Here God is being compared, first of all, to a rock, and then the verb is the rock that begot you. And in Hebrew, that verb begot can be used either for fathering or mothering. The act of conceiving the child, it can be both male and female. It's a very fluid verb that way. So we move from rock to father-mother imagery, and then in the second part, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. That in Hebrew is only a maternal verb, the God who forgave you birth. That's the act of a mother. What a rich, rich verse, I think. God is this rock birthing as a father, begetting as a father and a mother, conceive a child, and then birthing as a mother this child. There's another image in Isaiah 46. Isaiah is very rich in female images of God. Isaiah 46. Verses 3 and 4. Hearken to me, O house of Jacob, all the remnant of the house of Israel, who have been born by me from your birth, carried from the womb. Even to your old age I am he, and to gray hairs I will carry you. I have made and I will bear. I will carry and will save. And here there's an image of God, a very fluid image again. God is referred to, I am he. And some of the images there could be male, but they are also female. And this is one of the things that is so wonderful to me about the Hebrew mind, especially with sexuality sometimes. It's very fluid. Like in that Deuteronomy passage, we'll read in one verb of there's a verb that can be used for father and mother, and then it moves very fluidly to a mother image at the end. There's a lot of mixing of male and female, and there's not a sense sometimes that we need to be so consistent about whether it's masculine or feminine. It's very fluid. They'll talk about God as father, God as mother in one breath. And here it seems to be happening too. The images could apply either way, most of them, father or mother. And then in verse 4, I have made and I will bear. That's again the birthing image. I will carry and will save. So there's great fluidity in some of the Hebrew poetry in talking about God. There are also images of God as a nursing mother, as we found in Psalm 131. And I'd like to mention those to you now. They're both in Isaiah. The first is in Isaiah 49, verses 14 to 15. And here Zion is, the prophet is mimicking Zion, talking to Yahweh, and then presenting a response of God to the questions of Zion. But Zion said, "The Lord has forsaken me, my Lord has forgotten me." And the response of the Lord to that, "Can a woman forget her sucking child, that she should have no compassion on the son of her womb? Even these may forget, yet I will not forget you." What a fine promise that is, and such a profound way and a moving way of saying it. What mother, having nursed a child as they did in Israel for several years, they didn't wean children until 3 or 4 or 5. What mother could forget all those hours of nursing a child at her breast? And yet God says, even that mother could forget, maybe, but I will never forget you. And that's a very moving image to me of God as a nursing mother, and of God's love being even greater than that. The last is in Isaiah 66. And this is a little more complex, verses 12 and 13. And here there's a rich image starting in verse 7 of Jerusalem that's being developed. Jerusalem as a city, a woman being in labor. You can see verse 7. And the miracle here is that before the woman's labor even began, the child was born. And this sounds like painless childbirth, and that's what's has been happening to Jerusalem. And so God is saying, rejoice, you've been born before you even had to go through the birth journey, before the labor. But in verses 12 and 13, Jerusalem is being used as a metaphor to talk about God's relationship to Jerusalem. And so you can see how this works. "For thus says the Lord, behold, I will extend prosperity to her," to Jerusalem, "like a river, and the wealth of the nations like an overflowing stream. And you shall suck, you shall be carried upon her hip and dandled upon her knees. As one whom his mother comforts, so I will comfort you. You shall be comforted in Jerusalem." And I can hear this psalm in the background. I have no rational or historical proof that it's there, but I think this psalm, which the psalms were such a rich part of Israel's worship life, and I think this psalm must have been in Isaiah's mind when these passages were being written. There's finally an interesting image to me in the New Testament where Jesus compares himself to a mother hen. And that occurs in Luke 13, verse 34, and in Matthew 23, verse 37. It's parallel verses in those two Gospels. I'll read from Luke, because I turned to that first. This is after the encounter with the Pharisees. Jesus says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killing the prophets and stoning those who are sent to you, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not." Here Jesus is comparing himself to a mother hen, wanting to gather her chicks under her wings. I didn't grow up on a farm, but my Aunt Sadie did in South Dakota, and I remember visiting her farm one time when I was a little girl, and she had a chicken coop with a lot of hens in it, and we went out to feed the hens. I was terrified, but Sadie was a tall woman. So I held her hand, and we walked out to the chicken coop, and these hens were scurrying around all over the yard. And a big black hawk swooped overhead. You could see its shadow come across the ground. And all these chicks gathered, scurrying under their mothers. And I'll never forget that scene. And that's what Jesus is offering to Jerusalem here. I'll be as another hen, spreading her wings over you when the hawk appears in your life. But you run away. You won't come to me when I offer you this mother love. And what it does to me, several things. It shows me that Jesus knew metaphoric language and used it and understood it. And the power to me of a male person using female images to talk about himself is very profound, I think, that Jesus, this incarnated male, used female language, a female image of a mother hen, to talk about himself. So, those are the mother images that I wanted to share with you briefly. And there are two other questions that I asked at the beginning that I find very interesting. And briefly, I'd like to go into those and then leave time for discussion at the end. I'll do this in just a few minutes. One of the questions that all this prompts in me is, well, they're there, so what do I do with them? How do we use them? And one of the hard things in implementing the use of such female images, I think, in corporate worship is that they are not included in our pericopes. None of the that I've been able to find, at least the passages that we've read, are included in that, except for Psalm 131. And so I'd like to look at that. It's the psalm for the 26th Sunday after Pentecost, and explore briefly how one could use this psalm in a corporate worship setting to begin as a way of developing in our worship life together some of these female images of God. If you'll turn in your LBWs to page 29, you can see where it's listed. Down at the bottom of the page, 26th Sunday after Pentecost, cycle A, the year of Matthew. Psalm 131 is the psalm for that Sunday. And I was thinking, you know, if I were the pastor or a layperson on a worship committee, how could I get excited about using this psalm? So I looked first at the other lessons from Malachi, 1 Thessalonians, and Matthew. And you can look at these if you want, but I'll just run through this. Malachi and Matthew depict the pride of the Pharisees and priests. In Malachi, the Pharisees, God had made a covenant with the Levites, and the tribe of Levi, the priest tribe of Israel, and those priests have broken that covenant. And the Lord is furious with them and vows to curse them. In Matthew, Jesus warns the Pharisees. This is the series, "Woe to you, Pharisees! Woe to you, Pharisees!" And Jesus encourages the Pharisees then, after all these woes, to become humble as a servant. And in 1 Thessalonians, Paul praises those who have accepted the word of God and are living a worthy life of humility and servitude. So one of the themes that seems to me to run through that ties in with Psalm 131 is to become like a child. Become like a child at its mother's breast. Become humble and not proud and full of yourself and going your own way. But go back to the Lord, the source of your nurture. That's one link that I think could be developed in sermons and prayers and hymns. And I don't know the LBW enough, I guess, to have a lot of quarrels with it, but one of mine is that one of my favorite hymns in the SBH wasn't put into it. And I'd like to read you the first verse of hymn 210 in the in the red hymnal. It's a Grundtvig hymn. And it's been one of my favorites, and you'll maybe see why. Golden light, serene and bright, the sky is now adorning. As sleeping child in mother's arms, my God has shielded me from harm. I thank him for the morning. And in this hymn, Nikolai Grundtvig, the hymn writer, compares God to a mother holding a baby in her arms, shielding this baby from harm, and then thanking God for the morning where that mother is holding him. So that would be my hymn for the day. It's Xerox. Now thank we all our God is another one, who from our mother's arms has kept us on our ways with countless gifts of love and still is ours today. That is in the green hymnal. So that's another good one, I think. There's another way to go that would be interesting to me looking at this, and that's to look at the images of God that are developed in the pericopes. Psalm 131 talks about God as a nursing mother. In 1 Thessalonians, Paul compares himself to an exhorting father and develops father images. In Matthew, Jesus asserts, "You have one Father who is in heaven." And maybe in a sermon, what I do is develop some rich images of God as a nursing mother, an exhorting father, and a heavenly loving father. That might be another way to go. Just be real fluid like the Hebrews and develop them all together. We can also use these images, I think, in our daily prayer life. And I will never forget the time when a Roman Catholic sister and I were discussing imagery for God. This was in 1975. And I had reached the awareness that I was struggling with the exclusively male language that we used for God. But I hadn't moved into also using female language for God at that point at all. And so I was complaining to her about this and struggling with what to do. And finally she said to me, "Well, Christine, why don't you try praying to God as mother?" And I was just shocked. I was appalled. And it sounded like heresy to me. But there was enough longing in me for that I was willing to give it a try. I was very timid about it at first. I felt when I wanted to talk to God as mother, the word just wouldn't come out. It didn't sound right to me. I was hesitant about it. But gradually I began to realize that because I was able to do it, my understanding of God was becoming fuller and richer, and I was getting a bigger picture of God. I was knowing God better. And that seemed to me to be assurance that I was going in the right way. So that's another thing that I think that we can talk about among ourselves in our congregations and try in our to address God in female images and language in our private prayer life. There are two effects in the end now of when I thought about the question, how am I different now that I know about these images? And how is my understanding of God and my relationship with God different? The main thing for me, I guess, is what I've said already, that the fullness of God, the richness of God that has developed for me because I can image God and speak to God as Father and as Mother. Secondly, the effect for me personally has been enormous. Mary Schramm in her chapel talk last week talked about how she told the story of Pandora's box and talked about how in both the Hebrew, in the Jewish Christian tradition and in the Greek tradition, woman was responsible for bringing evil into the world. Pandora opened her box and all this evil flew out. And Eve was the one who picked the apple and gave it to Adam. And that for me has always been a very negative image and something that I as a woman have felt I need to apologize for. I somehow am more evil maybe than men because my sex caused this evil to come into the world. And I think that the tradition has sometimes encouraged that understanding or supported it. And finding these female images of God has given a counterbalance to that negative image of evil Eve and has made me value myself more as a woman, as a female. That experiences that are unique to my sex, like birthing and nursing, can be images for God. Has been really a profound experience for me personally, that body and being, I can be a metaphor for God, just as body and being, men in all their relationships and in the experiences that are unique to their sex, can be metaphors for God. So those are just some responses to those last questions that I've asked, given this material. And I feel a little breathless. I think I've brought up a lot of stuff, and I would love to begin to talk with you now about it. Yeah, Fran.
Could I compliment you, because I think that you offer these optional ways of considering the images of God in a very gentle way. And I think that's important.
Okay.
And you recognize that these perceptions, ways of thinking of our God, are new to many people. And I think that you do this in a very a way that I cannot imagine would be offensive, and I appreciate that. But I'd like to add that.
Thank you.
I think some of the images of God as weaver and spinner and seamstress are helpful too, because many people, men and women, experience that as something their mothers or other women do.
Yeah, that's right. And I haven't gotten into any of those images. We can have a session about that sometime if you'd like. But there are many other images of God that are mothering images, because they develop for God the tasks that women traditionally did in ancient Israel. And in fact, this is sort of a beside the point idea, but I was very interested to read in a book, Ancient Israel, by a man named Roland DeVoe, which is a very important anthropological study of Israel, that boys and men, as well as girls and women, were shepherds. And so that the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, all the imagery of the Lord as shepherd to the Hebrew mind, to the ancient Israelite, was male and female, which I had never known until I read this book by Roland DeVoe. But he had studied the anthropology of ancient Israel, and so the shepherd imagery has become really rich for me. But there are all kinds, as Fran said, weavers, seamstress. At the end of the fall story in the garden, God sews clothes together for Adam and Eve because they're naked and they're embarrassed. God makes the clothes for them. God is a seamstress making their clothes. There are a lot of images like that, too, that we could look into sometime. Yeah, Marilyn? Yeah, that's another image pointing to God. That's a very good point. Male and female created he them. Male and female together point to God. And it implies that just male alone or female alone doesn't point fully to God, but male and female points to the wholeness of God. That's Genesis 1:27. Yeah.
Women too are in the image of God.
Yes, that's right. It works that way also. Yeah, thank you.
Part of our problem in our culture is as we stereotype the roles of men. We have been, we're coming out of that now, but we have stereotyped the roles of men as strong and like Ron Berg said, they're never to cry, hard, physically, you know, what we've done.
Sure, macho image.
Yeah, the macho. And then the woman, soft, tender, loving. I have found a great deal of what we usually attribute as feminine quality in men. My husband is more tender than I could ever be. And if we're willing to see that, that will open our mind, I think, to the qualities of God. And that it doesn't have to be, male or female. But the qualities are there.
Yeah. That each of us, in a way, has these stereotype masculine and feminine qualities that are fluid in us, like they're fluid in the Hebrew way of talking about God. Yeah, that's really true. I don't know who's next. Jan?
To hear a bit of an insight, what you're talking about, mother humans, old Testament are there, but not you. I'm thinking, early days of wounds and rescue, and all such powerful images, far more. I'm speaking of a context we've written about Latin America this week. And for the Latin Americans, the Virgin Mary is a very powerful divine figure. And she, for them, is like an earth mother. She carries those characteristics, and they become religious. And I'm thinking maybe for many of us, that's a substance that's a parallel to what we're reading in the Old Testament. And I never thought of that way before.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think there's a lot of truth in that. I know Jung has, in one of his books, and I can't remember what title it is, but he has this theory that all godheads in cultures have four figures in them, and that our Trinity is missing one. And he claims that the Virgin Mary in the Roman Catholic tradition fills that spot, and also fills the need for the feminine, the female, in the Godhead. And that's Jung's theory, but that supports very much your insight, I think, about the Virgin Mary. And I think that in the Catholic tradition, that's been a rich source of this female imagery for God, which we haven't had in the Protestant tradition so much. Now, Martha?
I'm done with God language and use like LBW, which tends to use, I think, almost exclusively.
That's a hard question. I know at Holden here they've been struggling with that and have rewritten. Janet Grant, the registrar at Holden, has been on an inclusive language committee, and they have marvelous resources here if you are looking for material. They have taken the LBW services, the Matins and Vespers, and rewritten them using inclusive language for God and developing all kinds of images of God that go beyond King, Lord, Ruler, all these male images that the LBW has. In worship, I struggle with that a lot. And on my internship, with the help of the worship committee, we changed some of the things that the pastor said, which were easy to do and didn't have to be announced beforehand. Like in the service of the word, one of the dialogues begins, "Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe." And instead we said, "Ruler of the universe," and made that an inclusive term. But we didn't do anything with the congregational responses.
They were supposed to have taken out all sexist language.
They did, pretty much for people, for human language. But the language for God that they used is still King, Lord, images that are kind of are male in our heads. Yeah. Evelyn?
I want to thank you for sharing your story of personal trouble, because there are those who anyone who wants to use inclusive language is just jumping on a secular bandwagon and applying it to the church. You illustrate what I've found also in other people, that inclusive language is not a problem for some women or men. They never felt left out, but that there are others like yourself and like my daughter, who have, this has been a real personal kind of thing, where they never felt quite satisfied. There was something else about the image of God. Mm-hmm. I think when we respect and recognize that personal struggle, we see this. I think it's a movement of the spirit to broaden our concept of God, and it's not something that secular society all of a sudden has heard.